The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay. So I'd like to tell a story first that's maybe sublime, and then talk about what is really ordinary. And if a sublime story doesn't work, maybe the ordinary will. And the story comes from these ancient texts called suttas, teachings of the Buddha. And sometimes I love reading them because you get these little glimpses of a little conversation that happened 2,500 years ago, you know, the time of Socrates or Plato, or you know, it's pretty long time ago, and or a little like glimpse of some little event that happened with someone back then. And sometimes you get the name of someone, sometimes you don't get their name, and. So the story goes like this. There is a newly ordained monk, young man who's been ordained. And that means that he's left his ordinary life that he as he's known it, and it's called going forth. And it was a big deal in the ancient world to become a monastic, because you really had to step away from your ordinary life and career, family, all kinds of things. And you became someone who wasn't supposed to have any money and wealth, and was not allowed to store up food. So every day you were beholden on, your eating was dependent on the people who offered you some food. And you weren't even supposed to kind of explicitly ask. But you could have the lid off your bowl, the big bowl they carried, and that was a sign that you were available. So he was a newly ordained monk. We don't know his name. And every day he would go out for his alms round with his bowl and get his meal. He would eat it. That would be in the morning. He would eat it. And then he'd go to his little hut where he would dwell. The way it's stated, he would dwell at ease and be silent. So that was his routine. He would get up, go for alms, come back, go to his dwelling, and dwell at ease, silent. And then it came to be the time, once a year or so, where the monastics get together and sew robes, because that's what they wore. They wear these robes, and they would get old, discarded cloth that they would cut up and sew back together into the shape of the robes that they wore. So it was a kind of collective communal effort that they would sew together. But he didn't come and sew with the rest of them. So here you have this new monk, goes to eat, then just goes into his room and just kind of lives there at ease and doesn't communicate and doesn't come out to help or involve in the communal work. So the other monks thought, well, this is, you know, maybe they were thinking, this guy's slacking off, or this is a good-for-nothing guy, and lazy guy. He just eats, and then he goes to his room, and, you know, if it had been in modern times, they would have thought, I wonder what he's watching. And so they go to the Buddha and tell the Buddha. And so he says, well, ask the monk to come see me. So the monk comes, and the Buddha says, are you doing this? Is it true that you go for alms, and then you come back, and you eat, and then you go to your room, and you dwell at ease and silent the rest of the day, and you don't come out to be involved in the communal sewing that we do? And the monk, his reply is very simple. I think it's maybe the only words he speaks in the whole sutta, the little story. He says, I am doing my duty. I'm doing my duty. And that's enough for the Buddha to get this clue, I guess, or something, prompt, to look this guy over a little more carefully. And the Buddha could tell, when he really paid attention to him, that this man, this young monk, was a transformed person. That he had gone through the course of practice, the meditation practice the Buddha taught, and had come out the other end as a transformed, realized person, liberated person. And so then the Buddha called the monks together and said, oh, you know, yes, this guy is going off and, you know, goes to his dwelling and is dwelling at ease and is silent. But he's finished his work. He's complete. And now he's just, I guess, he did what he had to do. So the duty of a monastic is to practice diligently. You're not supposed to become a monastic because it's an easy way to get food or easy way to get dwelling. You're not supposed to become a monastic just to, you know, avoid work out in the world. The duty of a monastic is to, the kind of deal is you become a monastic in order to really give yourself over to do the practice, devote yourself to this path of liberation. And there were some individuals, some of the monks, who really took this seriously and really gave themselves over completely to it. And this is what this young monk had done. And he would go every day to his room, and he would, dwelling at ease, meant that he would dip into deeper states of meditation and then do his work there, explore himself, develop insights, develop concentration, all the way to becoming transformed. And I love this little story. I love the story of a young man who decides, young person who decides, this is what I'm going to do. This is the only thing that's important. This is what my life is about. And doesn't just kind of devotes himself to this essential thing of meditation and practice. And he receives the Buddha's approval of what he did. And it was okay not to go and be part of the collective sewing because he had important things to do, engaging in. And this feeling of being dedicated to something, to feel like, and then dedicated to spiritual practice or the path of liberation, and to really give oneself over to it fully, as if this is the most important thing to do, everything else kind of a secondary. It isn't that we're trying to integrate a little bit of our practice into our lives, but it's more the other way around, that we have a practice and then our life has to fit into that. And so the priorities for some people are this way. But this is what's important. And it's hard in our society to have this kind of dedication because there's all these messages of things we should do and are supposed to do and experience and attain financially or security or jobs or relational, all kinds of things that, you know, and we live here in our environment here with tremendous variety of opportunities and things to do and acquire and to watch. And many people, I think, have more dedication in the course of a day or a week to watching movies on TV or on their computer or just surfing the web than they do, for example, meditating. You know, if a person meditates for 45 minutes a day, that's a pretty serious amount of meditation. It's a nice thing to do. But there's, I think that in our environment here, I suspect that most people are on their device more than 45 minutes a day. And some of it's because of work, which maybe is necessary, but how much of it's really necessary, what's being done? And if what's really important is to engage in a path of liberation and do this deep inner work, really explore deeply into the spiritual life for oneself, why not give it more time and more dedication than some of the other recreational pursuits that we might do or things? So that's what this young monk had done. He had dedicated himself to it. So now the ordinary. So most of us here are probably not going to become monastics. Some of you might. It's a wonderful, I was monastic for many years and I loved it. It was a wonderful life for me. And I'm happy not to be monastic now. I'm happy with my life. Both are good. And but how, as lay people, how do we dedicate ourselves to practice? How do we develop ourselves and cultivate this to the same degree as, maybe, you know, I don't know, the same degree as the story of the monk and the same intensity or fullness, but how do we, you know, do this, have a dedication to spiritual practice, and how do we bring it as part of our life or make it our life in a deep way? So I want to say that from the perspective of having been a monastic in a number of monasteries, one of the very supportive aspects of that lifestyle is the whole lifestyle supports us to remember to practice, remember to be mindful and focused, remember to look at our minds and kind of clarify what's going on in ourselves, develop ourselves and kind of engage, you know. And you're always being reminded throughout the day. And monastics do a lot of the ordinary things that everyone outside of the monastery does. My first job in the monastery was to do carpentry, mostly with sanding. The second job I had, I was a dishwasher, and worked many hours a day doing the, you know, dishwashing machine. And then I was a cook, and did all kinds of things in the monastery, sweeping and cleaning and cooking. And it was also for a while in the monastery, I was what's called the town tripper. And that was a person who once a week would go into the city, way out of the mountains, down to the city with a little truck in order to bring supplies, food and stuff back to the monastery. So I was a driver, the chauffeur, you know, chauffeur for the produce and delivery guy. And so there's, you know, things people do, that those kinds of things in ordinary life. But the context of doing it was such that it was there was a kind of motivation, or it was more natural to bring a certain kind of reminder of the practice, the teachings, as I was doing it, as we're doing it. So a lot of the activities are ordinary, like we're doing it. So a lot of the question is not so much how do you do great hour-long, 10-hour-longs a day meditation, but one of the questions is how do you bring that little bit more oomph, sense of practice and dedication of practice, to the ordinary things that you do already. Maybe you don't have to do new things, and you know, maybe you don't have to go off and become a monastic, but maybe all the things you're already doing, or many of them, maybe you can do them in a different way. My sense, and I don't have this, you know, I don't have the real data to tell you the real number, but my sense, my guess is that if you were 20% more mindful as you went through your day than you are now, you would attain the kind of mindfulness that a monastic has living in a monastery. It's not like, you know, like way out of sight and out of, you know, that unattainable. It just takes, you know, some more than what, if you're already trying to be mindful in a day, a little bit more. And that it builds momentum, continuity, and something builds over time this way by practicing more. So today I'd like to do is offer two approaches, two kind of practices for how to bring a little bit more intensity or fullness of mindfulness to your daily life. And so your daily life can get some of the benefits that someone has who becomes a monastic. And the first is when you do something, just do that one thing. Do one thing at a time. We have a lot of examples of people who are doing two things at a time. If you walk around the city, it's remarkable how many people are walking around the city and hunched over looking into something in the palm of their hands. You know, they're walking and they're looking at their device, you know, or if they have a few idle moments, they have to wait maybe at the bus stop for the bus or wait for something. What comes out? You know, there we are, because we have to look. It's so important. That's so much there on that screen. But what about just waiting at the bus stop? just doing that simplicity, rather than filling the time. What about just walking down the street? Just do one thing at a time. So one thing that it only took last few years that are a little embarrassing maybe to say this, but this thing about really doing not only one thing at a time, but really give yourself over to it. And just do it and really make it your practice. You know, make it like what you fully do, like one pointed, this is what I'm going to do. And any movement, any kind of urge to end and stop and move on to the next thing, you just let that shed that and just do this one thing. And some years ago I started, you know, occasionally getting this news or this information that we were supposed to wash our hands more than I was. No one ever told me how long I was supposed to wash my hands. But then there was first thing I remember learning was this, recite the alphabet. As you know, and then it's 20 seconds, this 20-second rule. So it took me a little bit before I kind of like took that seriously. And then I noticed that when I took it seriously, it was a little hard to do because I was already, my mind was already, you know, a simple little thing, but I was already on to the next thing. And so then I decided, why don't I just make this the one thing? Why don't I make this my meditation practice? So that when I wash those 20 seconds, I'm fully, completely as I can in the washing. And so sometimes that's how I do it. And I close my eyes and I'm just really there. And especially when I started doing it, it was fascinating to watch my mind, how this urges to be finished and move on. You know, I have important things to do. You know, I'm like, let's move on. These are the same urges, same kind of activities of the mind that go on in meditation that we have to work with and contend with so that we can let go of them and shed them, quiet down, so we can be really here in meditation in a full, embodied, present way. A stilling of the busy mind, stilling of the mind that's spinning and running around and wanting things or thinking about things or eager for the next thing or something. To just and a certain kind of stopping of the mind. So you can do that. You can cultivate the ability to do that when you wash your hands after you go to the toilet. And you can count. And then you can have a debate while you're counting with yourself. This is silly. I can't do it. I'm the exception. You know, you know, and everyone else should do it. Or there's important things to do. Like, you know, they can't wait out there because of whatever's going on. You know, the 20, 19, 18. You can do countdown, make it more exciting. and to see if you can get to 1 or to 0. But isn't the point isn't to get to 20. The point is to get to here, fully here. Just this. And to don't just wait to you meditate to settle your mind, to let go of your distracted mind, your preoccupied mind, learn how to do it throughout the day so that you're here. There's a wonderful 4 lines from T.S. Eliot, 4 quartets that go something like, we will never cease. We will never cease our explorations, but the end of all our exploring will arrive when we return to where we started. When we arrive to where we've started and know it for the first time. The end of all our exploring will be to arrive at where we started and know it for the first time. You know, washing those hands? How could that be as profound as a monk who goes in his room all day long to meditate? I mean, that's so petty. You know, so ordinary. It doesn't count, right? What counts is, there's a lot of things that count in that. But one, in terms of the spiritual practice of Buddhism, it counts how you train your mind, what you do with your mind. It counts whether you let your mind race out and race along to all its preoccupations and concerns, or you learn how to still the mind enough that you're here in a more fully complete way, that you're really here. You've come to where you started, which is here, and you're really here. And the mind's not racing, not rushing, yearning, wanting, running away, just here. So this idea of doing one thing at a time, when you walk down the street, just walk down the street. And see, in the walking, can you let go of restlessness? Can you let go of the urge that there's more things to do and multitasking and checking for emails or whatever it might be? And learn how to stop the mind. Not completely, but to quiet the discursive mind, or quiet the scattered mind, quiet the fractured mind that's thinking and yearning and reaching and wanting and reacting. It's a great thing to learn the skill to quiet the mind. And rather than losing something in doing that, we gain ourselves. We arrive where we started, which is here in ourselves, in a bigger, fuller way. We know ourselves better. We're more multidimensional beings. There's more of us. There's a fullness of it. And there's a much less sense of lack. Most of the reaching forward of the mind, the spinning of the mind, the yearning of the mind, the wanting of the mind, usually comes from some feeling of lack or dissatisfaction or discomfort we have. But this learning to do just one thing at a time in a high-quality way is being settled in that activity. We can settle out the sense of lack or dissatisfaction. Just this one thing. And you probably have lots of opportunities to do one thing that's ordinary, things you already do. So it's not a matter of now suddenly becoming a superhero, super spiritual person who can meditate for hours and hours at a time. It means that when you brush your teeth, you just brush the teeth. The samadhi of brushing your teeth. Isn't that cool? And so if you add in your day, as you go through the day, and just bring that sense of just doing one thing at a time, when you're doing, 20% of the activities of your day, it doesn't have to be all day long, you'll get a lot of the benefits that come from going off and becoming a monastic. And you get it easy. It's free. Isn't that nice? I think so. Okay, so that's the first thing. The second idea that can take ordinary life and help with this kind of developing a strong sense of practice in it is called a steadiness of purpose. And what that means is if you have a purpose that you have, that you're going to dedicate yourself to. It could be a small purpose, ordinary thing, so it's some purpose, some task you're going to do, or it could be a big purpose. You hold the purpose steady. You don't allow yourself to easily get distracted from it. This is what I'm going to do. So it could be as simple as washing dishes at home. As you're doing one thing at a time, but you keep doing that one thing at a time. You don't do that one thing and then go and put the laundry in the dryer in the middle of washing the dishes. And then on the way back from putting the laundry in the dryer, then you go straighten out the pillows on the couch. But you're just doing one thing at a time, right? So, but you're doing a lot of one thing at a time, but you're doing all these different ones. There's something about just when you're going to really, if you can, within reason, stick with what you're doing. Don't let yourself get distracted from the activity you're doing. The steadiness of I'm just going to do this. Help support learning how to have this still mind or quieted mind, the mind that's quiet of its discursive neurosis, and how to keep it while we're in activity, while we're in our life. Hold steady. So when I was in the monastery in Japan, one evening I went into the kitchen. I think it was the evening. And one of the cooks was chopping vegetables. There was a table, and so I stood on the other side of the chopping table, and he was chopping, and I was had these questions for him. So I asked a question, and he put down the fork and his carrot or whatever it was, and he stood up and he looked right at me, and he answered. He finished, he picked up his knife, his vegetable, he started cutting again. So I asked my next question. He put down the knife, put down the vegetable, stood up straight and looked me right and gave me an answer. And I didn't really I'm kind of slow sometimes, so I hadn't really picked up like how there was this real intentness, beautiful intentness of purpose. He was just doing this, just doing meeting me and answering my question. So then, because I'm slow, and I asked a third question. So he did the same thing. He put the carrot down, the knife down, and he looked up at me and said, "Gil-san, Mr. Gil," he said, "you know, I have work here in the kitchen to do, and if you keep talking with me, I can't do my work." And I said, "Oh, then I understood." So I backed off. He was, you know, he could, of course, I mean, he was quite capable, man. I know he could have chopped and talked to me at the same time. But that's not what he was in the monastery to do. He was there to really be present for the things he was, you know, when he was doing it. And he wanted the steadiness of purpose. When he was going to chop his vegetables, he just wanted to be able to do that until it was done. If another occasion, time off in the monastery or something, had come up to him, I'm sure he would have been very happy to have had the steadiness of purpose of having a conversation with me. Hold a steadiness of purpose. This is particularly useful if you have bigger purposes of your life. If you have really important things you want to do with your life, it's so easy to get distracted. It's so easy to kind of get broken up and be confused by other things. But it's really a wise thing to go sort through one's life and sometimes put aside even worthwhile things to do so that you can really hold yourself to do something successfully. Really give yourself to a few things and to have a steadiness of purpose. To do too many things, jumping around, something internally in the psychophysical system, it's harder for it to be settled, harder for it to kind of come from that still place, settled place, or peaceful place, or awake place, or something. But if you can help, just do one thing and be steady on the purposes you have, hold the course of what's important for you. That allows something to get integrated or settled. And the analogy that I like for this was when I was a little kid. I remember, like in second grade, there was a sandbox in the schoolyard, and we get these little red U magnets. And we would rub it over the top of the sand. There was little iron flint or something in it. And they'd start if you do it enough, they start lining up, this little flints. So if you're able to hold the steadiness of purpose, all the little flint in you will line up. You know, all the scattered pieces of you can have a chance to get integrated and work together. So the sublime, maybe, is to go off, be a new monastic, do your duty, go to your room, and really give yourself over to lots of meditation. The ordinary path is to discover how to be more present in what you're already doing. And the two things that support that is doing, when you do something, just do one thing at a time. And then when you decide that something's important for yourself, the steadiness of purpose, be steady in it. Just do it. Keep with it. Follow through if you're committed yourself to doing it or you've made a decision, this is what I'm doing now. And then you'll get a lot of benefits And maybe you'll get the same benefits as that monastic who did his duty. You didn't do, for lay people, we don't have a duty like that, but we have a golden opportunity in this life to do something very profound in clarifying and liberating our minds and hearts. So, those are my thoughts today. We have about 10 minutes. If any of you would like to ask any questions, comments, want to offer testimonials about how you've done this one thing at a time, or steadiness and purpose, what you found useful, anything.
I'll bring you the microphone.
Hi, you guys. I don't know. It makes you louder. I was going to say, I haven't meditated for a couple months. I kind of stopped abruptly for personal reasons, but it was nice to come and sit again and to feel just the discomfort in my body that I haven't felt for a while. In a strange way, that was comforting.
So it was nice to feel the discomfort? Or?
Yeah. Because I've been ignoring it.
Fantastic.
And busy.
I think it's a wonderful thing, statement you just made. Just as someone would have the wisdom to... That's all you wanted to say? I love it.
Yes.
Yeah. to find it valuable to just... much better if your body and mind is uncomfortable to know it and inhabit it and live it than it is to stay so scattered and busy and caught up in things. We don't even know what's happening for us. It's a kind of a coming home. And then then our whole system has a chance to heal or settle or come together. And but to appreciate, it's fantastic. Thank you.
I find waiting really difficult. Uh-huh. You talked about waiting at the bus stop.
Uh-huh.
And I've, over the past many years of meditating, I'm doing more and more things one at a time, but waiting? Any?
Waiting.
Waiting is the hard one.
Oh, okay. So to do one thing at a time for you is to experience how difficult it is. Just do that. That's the one thing. It's a little bit like what the lady said. Just be with the discomfort. Get to know it. Become its friend. Let the restlessness or the discomfort or be it something that you learn about. Just like I learned I learned so much about myself. I was so surprised to discover the simple act of washing hands. It showed me all these ways in which, you know, I was off to the next thing already. So there's all kinds of things you can learn. So I think it's great that you're one-pointed difficulty. Just let it be difficult and sit inside of that difficulty and breathe and get to know it and make all the feelings that you have that add up to this is difficult. Let all those feelings feel that they have an opportunity to breathe with you. The opportunity to show themselves to you.
At first I thought that was just funny, but I actually think that sounds brilliant. Valuable. Thank you.
I love this comment. Come time, see, and learn to suffer.
Could you say a little bit more about befriending discomfort?
Well, we have these amazing bodies, minds, hearts. And it's very sophisticated what goes on under the hood. You know, we don't even know, you know, most of what goes on under the hood here in who we are. But we have an amazing capacity to want homeostasis, to look for healing, to become free, to not be caught up, not to suffer. And so we have these built-in mechanisms to give us warning signs that something here needs attention. Something here needs our love, our care. Something here needs something. And so if we didn't have those warning signs, I've heard there's people who like can't feel pain, and it's dangerous for them to walk around the world because they can hurt themselves and bleed and not know it and cause a lot of damage. I mean, it can be deadly for them. We're lucky to have pain sensors in our bodies so that we can get these warning things. So to have this discomfort, the whole range that we have, we're set up with these systems, psychophysical systems, that are designed to feel discomfort, to give us a message, is fantastic. We're so lucky. Learn the message. Don't take an aspirin every time you can. Don't drink alcohol every time you can if you're uncomfortable. Don't distract yourself from it. Don't get more busy so you don't feel it. This is an important message, discomfort. Discomfort has all kinds of realms and levels of teachings for us, what to learn from it, socially, personally, all kinds of things. So discomfort is our friend. It's here to take care of us. Learn the message. Stop and pay attention to it. And we have these amazing systems that want to self-heal. This is why meditation is so powerful. It's one of the optimal times to allow self-healing to happen. So a really good time to meditate is when you're uncomfortable. That's the time to befriend it and be with it. So this inner mechanism of settling, of opening, of integrating and healing can have a chance. So it's one of your best friends, your discomfort. It probably misses you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So one of the things I notice throughout my day is moving back and forth between being very present and feeling the constraints of time.
Oh, time, yeah.
And I'm wondering if you can talk about the working in being present in a context where one might have to move more quickly.
Well, when I'm at my best, then I realize that time is a personal construct. Other people are operating on, clock time, and I'm operating on clock time. But the feelings of there's little time, or there's a lot of time, those are all constructs of our own minds. And so that to be caught in those constructs is optional. It's possible to do things quickly and be outside of time. So, it's your making the time that feels constrained. It's your mind that's making that. A wonderful practice I've done, I haven't done enough for a number of years, but if I feel constrained with time, I feel like I don't have enough time to do all the things I have to do, I'll stop and meditate. And that's like crazy. I learned to do this because in the monastery, where I was for 1 year, I was a cook in the monastery, a Zen monastery, where the meals had to be served. Zen monasteries are choreographed like dances, like 20, you know, 18 hours a day dances. You know, everything's choreographed, and you kind of have to show up at a certain place at a certain time. So the food had to be exactly to, the food had to be ready at exact, you know, minute. And the whole monastery was kind of built around this thing, this timing of things. And so about, I don't forget what it was, like 10 or 15 minutes before the meal was supposed to be served up, the kitchen crew had to stop all their cooking and chant the Heart Sutra. And the first weeks that we had to do this, I was cooking, oh, we can't do that, we don't have time, we have to, we don't have time. We have to, you know, we have 10 minutes before serve up, and you have to, things not ready. This is the time we were working the hardest, right? Nope, you got to stop. And the Heart Sutra is long enough. It's a rhythmic chant, and you're just like, okay, okay, you know. And you can't speed it up because you're chanting with people. and then everything always worked out afterwards. So then I applied this to my life. When I felt kind of suddenly constrained for time, too many things to do, I would stop and meditate for 10 minutes. And then it seemed like I always had lots of time after that. And that taught me a lot about how it's so much of a construct, at least for me, a construct of my mind that I get caught up in. I think I have very little time. But that feeling of not having enough time, a lot of it has, at least in my mind, is a certain claustrophobia in my own mind. And that the kind of time that's created by mental claustrophobia. And so meditation can kind of clear the claustrophobia. And there's lots of time to do things quickly. Great. So we should stop now, but if you want to come up afterwards and ask me, you're welcome to. And I hope you all have a wonderful week. I hope that you find some meaningful ways to, whatever you're doing, just do that. And if it's no other place you're going to do this, do it washing your hands. Because you actually get two benefits. You know, maybe benefits. But one benefit is your personal benefits of being present and practicing. And you get the benefit, perhaps, of great compassion that you are trying your best not to be a vector of illness. And it's a way of caring for others in this world. And isn't that pretty cool to be able to do the same things? The same activity does both, develops your own practice and cares for others. I mean, how many times do we find that opportunity? If nothing else comes from tonight, that's a good one. Thank you.